morning, Father, Son. Thank you for feeding all living things on earth. Thank you, plant kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, animal kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, great spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Hello and welcome to Shaman's Keep. This is Caroline Wise King, your host, and I have a great guest for you today, someone very special. His name is Michael Dunning, and he's known as the U Shaman. That's Y-E-W, a tree called a U. He was born in Glasgow, Scotland, had a series of encounters with elemental spirits and near-death experiences, which led to visions, out-of-body and altered states of consciousness, as well as intense physical pain. It completely destroyed his health, but an encounter with an ancient yew tree healed him and led him to a 10-year apprenticeship with the yew, who taught him and initiated him into shamanism. It's an honor to welcome you to Shaman's Keep, Michael.
Thank you, Caroline. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm so interested in your experiences with the tree, but before we launch into that story, would you share a little bit about your encounters with the elemental spirits?
Sure, I would love to. It's an encounter that took place quite a long time ago now, mm-hmm. looking back to the late 80s, and I was left art school in Edinburgh. I was an art student, and I, like most art students, I didn't really have any resources or any particular prospects of employment. So a friend of mine, whose name is Ewan, which actually incidentally means yew tree, and it's amazing how many correspondences when I look back that there are. He suggested that we go up very far north of Scotland to try and make some money on a tree planting scheme up in the very far north of Scotland in a place called Thurzo. And Thurzo actually means Thor's River, as in the god of thunder, Thor's River. And mm-hmm. it's a very barren place up there. And beautiful, but quite desolate in some respects, and with a quite depressed economy at that time. Although, right near where I was, and this is quite significant to the story, was a nuclear reprocessing plant called Dounreay. And this is, to put it into context, this was right after the Chernobyl incident. So people were quite conscious of the nuclear threat, you know, and this idea of the concerns. So there we were up in this very denuded, barren land on this place where it was really just a case of planting these little saplings that would then be cut down, sadly, when they were big enough to be cut down. And we were in the middle of nowhere. There was no lighting. There was no water. There was no heating, no bathroom, just in these very rundown caravans in the middle of this terrible place. And one night I was wakened up is a little bit of a not quite correct. I was basically dragged out of a sleep state by a sense of absolute panic, and it was a feeling of being crushed but also choked by some mysterious force that was in the space within the caravan and all around my body, compressing and coming from all directions and pushing into me and choking me. And I began to realize that it had a fluidic nature, as if the air, the very air that we breathe, had been transformed into another substance, more like a a fluidic, vaporous, fluidic substance that actually was burning, and it was a sulfurous fluid. So I was in an absolute panic and was trying to claw myself out of my sleeping bag to figure out what was going on. And I could barely move. I realized that the weight of this what I began to realize as an intelligence was pushing my body down and pinning it down, basically. So, of course, as one's mind races at these moments where you're in a situation which is beyond our rational comprehension, we've already been catapulted and projected out of our normal range of conscious experience, and it's amazing how quickly the mind begins to clutch at and how fast it begins to process in that state where the sense you're feeling as though your existence is about to end. And my first thought was that there had been a leak at the nuclear plant. And I thought, this is it. You know, we're all going to die. It's right after Chernobyl, and this is another one, and we're all finished. And with a sense of sulfur, I didn't really know what it was at the time. It was like smelling a combination of burning car tires and burning flesh. It was an absolutely awful smell. But I began to realize that it was pouring into my body as though, you know, I was inhaling it as though I was inhaling the air. And this toxic, what seemed very, very toxic, began to seep into my cellular spaces in my body through my lungs. And I began to feel my consciousness being pushed out of my body. My body was no longer able to hold consciousness because it was dying. It was being killed. So I began to kind of leave my physical self, if you like, and sort of move out into this peripheral space around. And as that was happening, I began to realize that there was an intelligence outside of the caravan moving. It seemed to be moving. In fact, it was actually breathing the entire atmosphere. It was able to breathe me, the atmosphere, and everything else in a sort of rhythmic, slow rhythmic cycle. So I with what I had left of my sense of my body, I was able to kind of claw my way to the door of the caravan. Seems crazy, really, to be going to encounter something that, you know, was... But somehow there was this bizarre fascination that, you know, it's the end, this is the end, and I need to know what it is. And pitch black, of course. So I managed to push the doorway, which was just hanging off on a hinge anyway. So I was looking out, couldn't see anything, but could sense this incredible presence just watching me, witnessing me. And it was as if it coiled back. I mean, I'm missing pieces out here. This is a long story, actually, but I'm missing parts of it out. It coiled back like a serpent almost about to strike. And, I mean, that was my sense of, you know, the death knell. This is the end. And it pulled back into a kind of stillness, a weird stillness, which I now understand. I didn't understand at the time. And I thought, oh, this is the end. You know, my consciousness was further and further pushed, and my body was crushed further and further, as though I felt like, as though I was one single cell almost, you know, crushed down into this impossibly small space. And there was an enormous bang, and it was gone. And I collapsed down onto the floor of the caravan and sort of came gradually back into this more physical state and dragged myself back into the... you know, to sleep, and you know, it was very difficult. I was very emotional. I was weeping, and when I got up in the morning, of course, I was exhausted, and nobody else had experienced anything like it. I checked for footprints. There was nothing, and from that point on, I felt very, very different, and that was the beginning of a process that actually seemed chaotic, but when I look back on it, was very logical in a bizarre sort of way, and so I began to understand the order of that process of destruction only later.
So you said that your health deteriorated after that, and doctors couldn't help you.
Yes, there was very little could be done, and you know, it was a slow process, but it was almost as though there was some dissolving of. Like a combustion had taken place in my system, where I was really not able to hold on to reality in the way that we're used to holding on to. It kept slipping away from me all the time. And my health, I felt as though I was being drawn outward, and my health began to suffer. And bit by bit, you know, things changed, and there was another encounter a little bit later back in Edinburgh at this point, which turned things even worse direction, and, you know, my hair...
Was it similar? Was it similar to that one?
It wasn't, actually, and I'm always a little, you know, sort of hesitant about talking about the second encounter, but, you know, I'm getting, you know, more sort of used to talking about it, but it was actually a light phenomena that struck me.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it actually hit me in the head as though I thought I had been struck by lightning. And I've actually been struck by lightning since then. So I know the difference.
Oh, wow.
It was a light phenomenon, like a flash, a bolt of light that hit me in the side of the head. And from that point on, my health was shattered. I mean, I had to be helped home that evening, and it was actually out with friends in a social place when this happened, actually.
Wow.
I had to be helped home, and the next day, I'd lost my sense of balance. I could smell burning all around me. My skin felt as though it was on fire. My hair began to fall out. My skin turned yellow. And I really began to literally fall to pieces.
And you didn't have a spiritual context to understand what this was that
exactly
was happening?
Exactly, nothing like that at all. I mean, I had no... Mm-hmm. I had been an art student, very interested in philosophy and Marxist aesthetics, and very interested in intellectual affairs. Although as a child, I had obviously was very, you know, being drawn to the arts, I was a very sensitive child, so, you know, and artistic, but... I was also had this, you know, this desire to be philosophic, and you know, and I was very much my head at that time. So I had nothing to really to
relate this to. Right.
Yeah, no elders, no role models, nobody in the community around me who could make head nor tail of what was going on. And so I was pathologized from word go, and you know, lost a lot of friends, distanced myself from people, and became very isolated.
You needed a shaman.
I did. That's
what you did. You needed a shaman. So
I did. I had to do a do-it-yourself route.
Yeah. So tell me about your encounter, your first encounter with the yew tree, and how it healed you and worked with you.
Well, the yew is really a part of this pattern, and I call this encounter up north. I call this being the elemental sulfur spirit. Now, my understanding of it has deepened. And this sulfur spirit is connected to the yew, and I can explain that a little bit later, which is quite an interesting and bizarre connection that relates to the early conditions of our Earth, our planet. And so when I was living in Edinburgh and having a difficult time managing my life, you know, not able to live independently any longer. I was really not able to cook for myself. I was forgetting to do things, you know, I was having, not able to pay bills and all that kind of thing, and falling to pieces. I was sort of rescued by a friend who took me out to her cottage, right outside of Edinburgh, on this beautiful, beautiful southeast coast of Scotland, nearest town called Dunbar, which is really, really lovely. Dunbar is famous for Mary, Queen of Scots, and all of that. And it was there that she began to really help me, actually. So there was a human intervention, in a sense, where she kind of changed my diet, helped me to kind of slow down and help me a little bit. And one day she was just chatting to me. She said, "You should really do with socializing a little bit. Let me organize a little night out for you, and we'll have you go out with the tree surgeon, the local tree surgeon, friend of mine." And I said, "Oh," I was really reluctant. I said, "Oh, okay." Wasn't very happy about it. And so off we went down to this bar, myself and Bob, who was a tree surgeon, the local tree surgeon. And of course, things went from bad to worse in this little village pub, as you can probably imagine, in Scotland. And it was a little riotous. And so by 2 o'clock in the morning or so, Bob turns to me and he says, "I'm going to take you up to see the yew tree." And I said, "What tree?" He said, "The yew tree." And I had no idea what he was talking about at all. I'd never heard of a yew tree. And he said, "It's the local wonder of this area. It's wonderful." So off we went, bumbling along in his van. And, you know, he was quite inebriated. So it was a bizarre night. So it was quite a bit of a moon that night, and we got up to this old Victorian estate. And all these old estates in Scotland and also in England were prized by the Victorians, who were collectors, as you know. They collected, you know, rare species of plants and all of that. And they had walled off these estates with these big red stone walls. And, you know, now that we're having creeping vines growing over them because they'd gone a bit ramshackle and into some disarray. So we had to climb over fences and walls and what have you, and through all the broken bushes and things. And I thought, what am I doing? I'm sick as a dog. I have no energy. I can barely walk as it is. And I'm staggering around with a drunken tree surgeon. I have no idea where I'm going. And finally we get to this, what looks like a huge bush. It's just this black. It's dark. It's fairly dark, but there's some moonlight. And it's a fairly dark, it looks like an enormous bush. It doesn't look like a tree at all. It just seems to be going everywhere, like the biggest bush you've ever seen. And an even blacker hole down on the ground that looked like an entrance. And I thought, oh, God, what is this? And next thing I know, his hands are on my back, and he's saying, off you go. And he shoves me into this freezing cold black hole. And I'm staggering down. I realize that I can't stand up because I'm jagged. I'm pierced on all sides by this sharp wood.
Yeah, and I think, tree limbs.
Yes. And actually, I thought, what is this? And I realized that I was in a tunnel. I could not move to the left or to the right. I could have gone backwards, but Bob was going to kick me forward. So I kept on moving forward, and I was in a tunnel, and I kept on going. It was freezing cold. The temperature got colder and colder, and I was moving further into this. And it began to rise up. Now, we're talking about 40, 45 feet here of a long tunnel of the same living, sentient tree. And I'm moving through this tunnel, and comes up into a rise, and there's some old iron railings that somebody has placed just to help to open up the space to walk into the central chamber. And this is a stunning, stunning chamber of living wood that descends down from the trunk of the tree in these beautiful, graceful arcs, descends back down to the earth, and like serpentine flowing patterns, all these branches in a perfect circle moving all off into the periphery. So you're inside this living, sealed chamber that has one way in and one way out, and this beautiful living branch contortion. And I could kind of make it out, the central bowl of the tree, the central trunk of the tree, and I walked towards it. I couldn't believe that I was in this presence of this living being who I immediately recognized as divine. In my own way, I didn't have that word necessarily, it wasn't what came to mind, but in my own sense, I was virtually pushed to my knees with the power of the divinity of this being. And I very quickly became very crystal clear in my consciousness and realized that this being was going to be extremely important to me. And Bob strolled up behind me and very irreverently sort of said, welcome to, you know, one of the wonders of the world. And I said, you know, it can't be the same. It's all different trees, isn't it? He said, nope, it's one tree. And it's a she. And it was amazing to me that I was in the presence of this divine feminine ancient being. And the next day I went back, and I wept, and I was thrown into convulsions, actually, under the tree. And that began the first of this long, long, arduous process of healing and learning that lasted over 9 years under this chamber.
My goodness. So actually the tree was helping extract that poisonous energy that had come into you, and it was helping heal your body from it.
In a way, yes, but the two were paired. The you, I mean, this is something that probably would have time to go into on the show, but the you has always been called the ironwood.
Yes.
And it's also called the red branch, and there's also used to bleed a substance that looks like blood in Wales, and there's the famous Nivern yews which bleed. The bleeding yews. Now, this is extraordinary.
Really?
It relates to the bigger picture of the yew in connection with the Holy Grail and with the actual, in the esoteric Christians, with the blood of Christ. So there's huge, this is an enormous, enormous story that I'm digressing briefly here, that has only been beginning to be told now, particularly by people in Wales, myself. There's a book I just wrote the foreword for that just came out in 2012 by Janice Fry, and Janice and I have been having a lot of correspondence. So there's a few of us now coming together to tell the story of this great tree that goes back to our earliest origins, and it's related to iron in the strangest way, and related to the blood in a very bizarre way that I could go into a little bit. But so in a sense, they're related beings. The sulfur spirit and the yew are both ancient beings. The being that I met up in the north was a being that had been pushed down into the earth, if you like. It's a being that had existed. You could almost call it an early dragon, bizarrely enough, in a way, that was more sulfur, not in the sense of the periodic table, but sulfur in the sense of an archetypal, more of an archetypal spiritual elemental sense, more like an etheric sense, that these beings had occupied the earth before it had solidified. So there was more of a sort of a dragon forces moving in the earth that had gradually descended down into the earth. And these dragon beings were, one of them is what I actually met. My theory is that the disturbance at Chernobyl and some of the disturbances that were happening in the world at that time had kind of brought this being back up from the surface. And perhaps, too, in connection with me, perhaps, you know, that's I wouldn't want to be arrogant. You know, my role is simply to be a servant of the tree and to take its message forward. So the sense of then me being connected, brought to this tree as another stage in an initiation which was connected to the early origins of human beings, because the actual tree, can I say a wee bit more about this? Just briefly.
Yes, of course.
When you think back, or to make this more sensible, if you think back to the old the ancient king lists, the ancient lists of kings from Sumer and Babylonia and things like that, you think some of these kings were given ages of 30,000 upward years, and in ridiculous amounts of years. Now, some of these kings, like Enki and Ea, were seen as these kinds of early versions of Yahweh, for example, Yahweh Elohim, connected to the Garden of Eden before this was, of course, a Christian idea. Now, Ea, this god Ea, is actually another word for the yew tree. And the yew, it's very interesting, just because the old Hittite word for the yew, Ea, shows up in the movie Avatar, actually, as the tree of life, or something like that, in that movie. So these old serpent, what they were called, the Ashumgals, the dragon, the great dragon serpents, were regarded as standing in Eridu, as the former Eden. So these beings may have been actually early versions of the trees that formed as the earth was beginning to move from a fluidic to a more solid state before humans had come. So there was these early gods who lived for thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years, who basically expressed eternity in their living nature, in their actual gestures, who were able to become both male and female, who were able to restore themselves, who were able to take on different shapes. And interestingly enough, the yew tree that stands today in Scotland and the other yew trees that are there continue to express those gestures. They can be both male or female. They can change their sexes. They are actually eternal beings. They will not die if they're left alone. So there's a being amongst us on this earth today that retains the functions of beings who existed in the earliest times of our earth before it had even fully solidified. So in a sense, we're talking about Lemurian beings connected right back, who probably, now this is something that people might balk at, but my sense, given from the tree itself, is that these trees in Scotland are so old that they were around before the supposed flood, well before the Ice Age, before the flood. These trees are absolutely so beyond ancient, because they can continuously rejuvenate themselves. They are the oldest living things on the planet.
That's amazing. When you think about trees that live for thousands of years, the human body seems so puny and fragile, doesn't it?
Oh my goodness, yes.
In the lives of these trees, nations have risen and fallen, and emperors and kings have come and gone, and Jesus came and went, and all the great teachers and all the great people of earth have come and gone, and these trees are still rooted solidly in the ground and observing all of this life that goes on.
Yes.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. Not only rooted, but the tree that I spent time in there is actually a sealed chamber. In a sense, it marks a spherical shape, in a way. It's a tree with an inside. I mean, trees don't have an inside. Normal trees don't have an inside. The yews, in a sense, are all about peripheral space marking off an internal space. They're initiatory chambers. Mm-hmm. They're chambers that are really archetypes of the spiritual plan of a human being. They're embryological trees. They tell us about our own origins. And one of the things that I found very powerful in my initiatory experiences was that what was happening to my body, the peripheral nature, the sense of being drawn out into peripheral space and being reconstituted and rebuilt, was exactly how we all come into existence, from the periphery into the center. That's how embryologically we all begin, and that has led me to a very intensive study of human embryology from a spiritual perspective, which has really shed an enormous amount of light. In fact, the essence of the five trees that I teach is based on some of that work and how we can actually begin to embody that as a factor of a new development potentially for human beings. That sounds a little grandiloquent, and I don't mean it to sound grandiloquent, but this is what I'm being told by the youth.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we know that we're spirit beings living temporarily in these bodies or garments that we put on to live in the physical world. And we also know from energy work and everything that our auric field is where everything starts. Like if illness comes to your body, it comes into your auric field first, and then it works its way into the actual physical body. And so it can be removed from the energy field and as a healing modality. And so that makes a lot of sense what you're saying.
Yeah, you put it well. And I think there's for me, it's a sense of rather than thinking of it as an energy field, as an actual living organism that accompanies a human being that I call the dragon body. In relationship to the actual tree of life, because the yew tree is the original tree of life. It's the Ea that stood in the Garden of Eden. It's the Yggdrasil. It's now been conclusively shown to be Yggdrasil. And when you look at Asgard and the Norse traditions, you see the yew everywhere you look. It's quite extraordinary that from Heimdall to Ul, the god Ul, to even the name Asgard, to Idavol, which was the name of the place where of Asgard, which actually means Ida means you, and the Vol means something that can renew itself. So there's endless, enormous connections between the you and our early origins. So for me, this dragon body, this peripheral body, is the body that you're speaking of in another way that accompanies a human being into existence, and we see it in the membranes that surround a human before they come into. Before the spirit can take hold of the dimensions of matter. So there's a great principle here that's being evoked, a great spiritual principle that a lot of the work I'm doing seeks to develop the perceptual ability to be able to really work with that principle of coming into being as a healing modality, as something that we can use to be of service to others, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yes, that field around us has been called many things, the auric field, the luminous body, many different ways of talking about it and working with it. But we do know that healing can be accomplished by working just with that field, and it then takes effect in the physical body. So that's awesome.
You're absolutely right. I think taking that a little further is to say that, too, that you know, when we look at the way a human being comes into form, you know, we're so addicted to the mineralized body, this whole idea of ourselves as having a nervous system that we use to organize ourselves, a sensory nervous system, really truly the cerebrospinal nervous system that we use to move around and organize ourselves from. The healing that really comes to us, the deeper healing comes to us from the outside in.
Yes.
So that body, that dragon body, the body that you're talking about, the luminous body, the auric body, that's the body that where the healing comes from. That this body mm-hmm. that we have, this mineralized body, is actually going through a death process. It actually isn't really very adequately able to heal itself. It needs a placental body. And the dragon body that I speak about in my work is really essentially, it's part of the older traditions that were called, usually they were related to the dragon, or what was called the placental guardian. You see it in the old Kuna Indians and all of the early creation mythologies, this idea of a dragon that comes in. And of course you see it in the esoteric Christian traditions with the, excuse the pun, with the Michaelic forces, the forces of Michael. So it's a big story, but the dragon body, the second body, is a wonderful perceptual journey
mm-hmm.
that I've certainly been on for many years.
Yes, you have. Well, you know what's so interesting to me? I've read about the yew, and it says that every part of the yew is poisonous. The leaves, the twigs, the roots, everything except that red cup that holds the seed cup. And yes. Yet, in the 1980s, medical science discovered that there was a substance in the yew bark that actually helped fight cancer. And so they have harvested a lot of yew trees just for that substance.
It's a tragic, in ways it's an interesting reclamation of old wisdom from the tree, given mm-hmm. from the tree, but denigrated in a way. I mean, not to downplay, I say in my website, not to downplay the cancer of the people who survived through having this Taxol or paclitaxel treatments, but it's incredible how, you're right, you're absolutely right, how everything in that tree, in a sense, it has a certain degree of poison, apart from the mm-hmm. arils, which is the berry. And that berry, that yew aril that comes on the female tree, was really something that goes way back, connected to the early soma, the drink, this kind of ambrosial drink, this drink of immortality.
Oh.
Very closely connected to it. And I was shown that very clearly in the visions under the yew by the druid priests, or the druid shamans, or the bird shamans, as I call them, who looked remarkably like early Assyrian, the Anunnaki figures watching the Tree of Life. These figures were my teachers under the tree, and were very clear that the berry, the arrow was used to prepare a sacred drink, and that, interestingly enough, the bark of the yew gives off an alkaloid toxin, which is hallucinogenic.
Ah.
It's really quite amazing. But the studies you talk about started in the 60s, and, you know, as you say, they're being harvested now, and India has lost a great amount of its use, unfortunately, through this. And there's a problem here, and we're facing some issues. Luckily, the old trees in Britain, although they're not officially protected, seem to so far have survived, and most of the cuttings now can be taken from bushes, younger bushes. But the problem is now they're using they're manipulating the genetics to make the trees, the bushes grow quickly, and that's going to ruin that reduces the gene pool for the older trees. So there are problems, and groups like the Ancient Yew Group in Britain have been set up to try and raise awareness of the yew tree, and various writers that I've been in touch with recently who are doing some wonderful work to try and protect this legacy that we have. You know?
Yes, because the yew tree is a very slow-growing tree, which probably accounts for its some of its longevity, is that it grows very slowly. So it's sad to hear that they're genetically altering it to try to make it grow faster so that they can harvest more for the drug companies.
Yeah.
That's discouraging to hear that.
It is, yes. Yeah. And you know, I'm not up to speed on, to be honest, I'm not up to speed with the absolute down-to-the-minute politics of that. So mm-hmm. there may be somebody listening who knows more about that than I do, but certainly I get kept generally connected to it through my contacts in Britain who are more connected to that. But for those interested, I can certainly help to direct them if they want to find out or do a bit more research on that. You can go to my website or contact me that way.
Okay, and your website is yewshamanism.com.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Youshamanism.com. Okay, wonderful. Yes, you have some great links on there. So I would urge all of you listening to the show, if you're interested in learning more about this, to visit his website, youshamanism.com, and some wonderful information there. Now, I understand that in parts of Asia, the yew was known as the tree of God. Tell us a little bit about that. The tree of God.
The tree of God?
Uh-huh.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's right. I mean, there are incredible connections with all around the world, actually with the yew. Janice Fry has just written a book called The God Tree, and she explores some of these connections in her book in great detail. And for those who are interested in really getting into that, I think her book, Janice Fry, called The God Tree, is really worth taking a look at, and that's a wonderful work. But yes, it shows up in connection with the gods. In Japan, for example, there's still traditions where the rulers have a certain kind of yew staff that is used. I can't remember the name of it now. Shaku, I think it's called, a yew staff that is used, and the yew staff is something that goes right back to the Grail saints, connected with the Holy Grail, and right back to Joseph of Arimathea, and right back to Moses in that tradition, and right back before that to some of the Assyrian images. And you'll probably bring to mind yourself, if you think of these figures with the beaks, with the bird faces, they're often holding a branch. They're often depicted holding a branch from the Tree of Life. So you get this idea that there are this legacy of branch carriers who sought to bring forward the eternal qualities of this ancient being, so that the lineage was not forgotten, so that the lineage was passed down and protected, and that lineage was protected now, and this is traceable right into the 14th, 15th century. There are still yew staffs existing that in Scotland that can be dated back to the Middle Ages that were brought from the Holy Lands after the crucifixion planted. Isn't it quite extraordinary?
It is. My goodness.
One of the most extraordinary things about this, I'll just tell you a brief story. There's far too much here. But is that when, after the crucifixion, and incidentally, Janice Fry, myself, and the others involved in this yew work believe that this figure of Christ was crucified on a yew tree. So these saints, Joseph of Arimathea, came to Britain after the crucifixion with a staff. Mm. Now, in the 60s, there was an archaeological exploration of Chalice Well, the area of Chalice Well, looking for the Holy Grail. And this is where the story gets very, very, very deep. They're looking for the Holy Grail in the 1960s, and they're digging down at the Chalice Well. And what do you think that they find? 11 feet 6 down, or 11 feet so down in the earth.
A what?
Well, they find a yew, an evidence of a yew tree that had grown there.
Oh, my goodness.
So if Joseph of Arimathea, and the monks of Glastonbury say this, if Joseph of Arimathea had brought a yew staff cut from the tree that Jesus had been crucified on, brought it from the Holy Lands to Britain, was deliberately planted at the site of the Chalice Well, and there was a yew grew there that was probably destroyed in a period of warfare or for religious reasons to disguise the Druidic roots or the early roots of Christianity, the pagan roots of Christianity. That implies to us that there's a connection here between the Holy Grail and the yew tree that you see showing it up in the Knights Templars, you see it cropping up in other places. You see it showing up in Rosalind Chapel in Scotland. The story is a very, 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 very big story, and it connects us all, actually. And it's a huge story. So if I get sort of breathless talking about it, it's because I go in so many directions. I have to stop myself.
Well, yes, I understand, and and because the yew tree is so ancient, and tribes all across Europe venerated it, and I understand that that's actually where the name Europe came from, was the yew tree, yew for Europe, that whole area as people who were part of the yew tree. I don't want to call it a cult, but a belief system that this was the source, the tree of life.
I think I didn't know that connection with the word Europe, but I know that there's Fred Hagenador in his book A Yew, A History has touched on the word Europa in connection with the yew tree. So I'll look back on that. But mm-hmm. that's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. I didn't know that.
And I came across some information that said the oldest man-made artifact that we have in the world is a spear that was made from yew wood, and they've dated it at 150,000 years old.
That's right. That's right. And the oldest musical instruments in the world are a set of yew pipes that were found in Ireland.
Oh, my goodness. No wonder they called it ironwood. It lasts forever.
It lasts forever, but also it's to do with the blood, and that's the other connection with iron, which is really quite fascinating. Iron as the force that allows incarnation to be possible. So there's a great lineage that goes right into our blood that connects with this tree. So a lot of the work I'm doing is exploring our connection with our blood and how we work with that on an occult basis, if you like to use not such a great word, but. That's some of the exploration of the work I'm doing is working with the deeper nature of our blood in connection with this ancient being.
Hmm. I'm not sure we have time to go into that part. But that's we only have about 8 more minutes to the show. But anyway, I want to mention that the Magna Carta, that famous document, was signed under a yew tree in Runnymede. In 1215, and I understand that tree is still alive.
Yes, it's called the Ankerwick Yew. You're absolutely right.
Oh my goodness! Imagine it was standing there in 1215. Oh
yes.
My goodness! And they were signing a document under it and making this agreement
already,
that went down in history, the Magna Carta. Yeah.
Yes, and it was already an ancient tree at that time. And, the yew I spent time under, I mean, they only grow 0.02 inches per year on average. So that's a rough kind of guess, but they're extremely slow growing. And but it was interesting when you mentioned the Ankerwick yew connects to the word ank, which is the Egyptian word for the ank. So the Ankerwick yew... And Runnymede is connected to the rune, of course. So there's a connection with Egyptian origins with this yew, and the yew was regarded by Ralph Ellis, for example, as the Egyptian tree of life. And you see it showing up in ancient Egyptian burial rites and funerary rites. What's even more bizarre about this is that Queen Skota, who was the daughter of Nefertiti, when she left Egypt. She is reputed to have ended up in, first of all, Scotland, and then Ireland. And some people say that's where Scotland's name came from, was from Queen Skota, from Scotland. Oh. And she ended up in a place called Inverah in Ireland, which means place of the yews. And it was there that she's supposed to have been interned. So many of the early pharaohs talked about coming back to their ancestral homelands after they had died. And these ancestral homelands were identified as islands that resemble Scotland and Ireland. So there's a huge story there. And just to finish that little piece off, I think it was about 1320 or something, it was the Declaration of a Broth, I think it was called, a document in Scotland. It was written in Scotland to prevent the English from trying to have claim over Scotland as its right. And the Declaration of a Broth talks about the Egyptian origins of the Scots, therefore saying that the English had no right to claim rulership over the Scots because their legacy was of a different kind. And what's even more bizarre is that Declaration of a Broth actually formed part of the US Constitution.
Oh my. Really?
Yes. It was used partly to model some of the US Constitution, so it's quite extraordinary.
Wow. And what is the name of that document?
I'm pretty sure, if I'm wrong about this, I do apologize, and we'll make sure that we get it right, but I'm pretty sure it's called the Declaration of Arbroath, and it was about 1320, I think it was written, to protect the Scots from the claims of the English, who of course were always trying to take Scotland over.
Right. Okay, it was a declaration of what? What was the last word?
It's A-R-B-R-O-A-T-H. Arbroath.
Okay.
And Arbroath.
I want to look that up myself. This
please
is fascinating.
Do, let me know if you, I haven't had time to look into that in any great depth, so please look into that and let me know. And there's somebody in Wales actually doing research on this just now called Paul Greenwood, and he's doing some meticulous research on the U and some of these much more obscure connections with the Templars and Robert the Bruce and William Wallace, and who are all connected to the U. So there's a lot more to come, around this tree.
Yes, I think, the feminine energy is rising again on Earth. And, of course, throughout history, many festivals around the U were in recognition of the female energy, the great goddess by all her many names. And even at different times of the year for different festivals and everything. But it was all the energy of the goddess, the compassion, forgiveness, contemplation, insight, and inner peace that is connected with the goddess energy.
And that's beautiful, because what you've really done there is really brought the stillness and the poise and the femininity and the grace, because that's what the yew tree is really all about. It's a place of absolute balance. There's a great stillness there. There's a great power to restore and change one nature into another nature through a deep connection with origin. And it's incredible how you're absolutely right. It really is a much more of a feminine principle, and that is a story all unto itself.
But I notice in your mention of the yew tree that you sat with for the 9 years that this was a female tree.
Yes.
So that you were nurtured by all of that great goddess energy.
Oh, absolutely. And it really is a living womb. And, it doesn't take too much of a stretch of imagination to move into this idea of this you as a sort of a placental guardian, a placental being, a womb-like being that supports a human being. And I think that my sense and the visions I had under the you were of being a great place of ritual and transformation and initiation. So for me, it felt to me like what was happening with me was actually had happened before with others. It hadn't happened for a long time, but it had happened before in the past. The difficulty that I have, of course, is to translate what happened under the tree into a language that is understandable to me, first of all, but also to those people that, who are attracted to the you and who may want to pursue some of this work with the you and with myself and with the essence of the five trees. And it's just the beginning. This is just the beginning. There's still an early stages. I'm only now getting ready to really take this work forward and take it out a little further. I've been really incubating it and working with it quietly. But now it's time to start to really take it forward.
Yes, it is, because the trees are so important to life on Earth. And we have deforested most of the planet now. And we have to remember that our lives are rooted in the trees. The trees are what support life here, the oxygen we breathe, and all the things that sustain life here.
Yes, you're absolutely
go back
right.
To the tree. Yes.
Yes, and there is our connection with iron again. So I mean, and our blood, and the way we breathe, and the way we have come into solid form to live as a spiritual being. So
yes.
The yews and all the trees are involved in that, and you're absolutely
yes.
right. In fact, bizarrely enough, at the moment they're trying to find another classification for the yew tree, because they're realizing more and more and more that it's not quite a tree. In fact, it doesn't quite follow the exact categories of a tree. It's a different kind of being. So at the moment there's a different classification being looked at for the yew. So it's always been my sense that it's a tree, and yet it's much more than a tree. Not to put down trees, but it's something that has preceded all of the trees that we see
Yes, Michael, we're running out of time here.
Oh, okay.
I'm so sorry. I would love to talk more about this, but thank you so much. Well, I've enjoyed every minute of it. Thank you for joining us today.
And
oh, you're welcome. And for my listeners, next week, Renata Ash will rejoin us so we can continue the conversation we started a couple of weeks ago about the chakras and the healing essences and everything. So join me next week. Until then, may the sun kiss your face, may the waters bless your body, and may all nature sing in your presence.